So we're on page 21. In the seventh of the 7 points, the precepts of mind training. And we're halfway down on the left side. Do not depend on other conditions. So let's see what that says. To engage in other spiritual practice, is it essential to gather various favorable conditions such as food, clothing, and so on. You also need to have good health, access to water that is suited to your body, and no excess disturbances from humans and non-humans alike. The practice of mind training is, in contrast, does not depend on such conditions, since the very absence of favorable conditions is itself a resource for this spiritual practice. Today, take all of those as a ripening of meritorious karma and as factors conducive to mind training. So here, what we're saying, of course, is that in the mind training, as a beginner, of course, it's good to have conducive conditions and to gather that if we can. But if we don't, then that's also okay, because here we're saying in the mind training, we can take even the lack of good conditions as support for the spiritual path. We can take adverse conditions into the past. So we don't need to have to have good conditions to be able to practice. Of course, as a beginner, not too many adverse conditions may be useful, but of course, as we progress, then we'll actually need to look for these adverse conditions to go further in the practice, but not to need to rely on them to be able to practice. This is what this verse is saying. Engage in the principal practices right now. So here, there are some six pairs of practices, and one of those is the principal of the two. So let's have a look at those six pairs and see which one is the principal right now. Since beginning this time, you have roamed in the three lower realms of existence as if you were there, as their ancestral home. Today, at this juncture, when you have obtained the human existence of leisure and opportunity that is so rarely found even in a billion eons. So often we see that when we look at the whole six realms of existence within Buddhism, that if we end up in not a very good existence, to get from there back to human existence is extremely difficult. And that's what's being mentioned here. The fact that we've got here, very difficult, but we're here now, so what to do? It says, instead of making all kinds of plans for this life, it is more important to engage in Dharma practice that aims for the welfare of future lives. So that's the first of the two, is whether to get in spiritual practice versus mundane pursuits, you know, the eight worldly concerns. So the principal practice now, of course, is not simply to get caught up in the eight worldly concerns, but to engage in Dharma practice or spiritual practice. Of the two aspects of Dharma, exposition and practice, the latter is more important. So when we talk about Dharma, we can talk about the Dharma of scripture and Dharma of realization, or study and practice. So that's what says here, the Dharma exposition, which is scripture, and practice. So therefore, of course, the latter is more important, meaning if we just leave it as intellectual understanding, then it's not going to really benefit us. We need to put that into practice. We need to come to realize. So that is more important. And there's a Tibetan saying here that says, let the Dharma be in your heart and not in your mouth. It's very easy to say very nice Dharma things, but have we internalized them is the question. And then the third of the six pairs, it says here, compared to all other meditative practices, the practice of training in the awakening mind is more important. So here we're talking about cultivating bodhicitta versus other meditation practices. So the more important, of course, the main practice here is bodhicitta, the conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. So that's the third pair. Compared to training the mind by applying the two paddles of scripture and reasoning, It is more important to persistently train in applying the appropriate antidotes on the basis of your teacher's pith instructions. So here we have pith instructions versus using scripture and reasoning. So what's more important is to follow the pith instructions, because they are very direct instructions to come to realize nature of the mind and so forth. Whereas using simply scripture and reasoning is sort of the longer approach. So what's more important is to follow the teacher's pith instructions.
What is pith?
Pith, essence. Compared to other activities, training by remaining seated on your cushion is more important. So here, the two is meditation versus other activities. So what is more important, of course, is the meditation, because without meditation, we can't internalize anything. And then the other activities won't be meaningful anyway. Of course, we need to engage in other activities as well, but what is more important here is to work on the meditation, to come to realize these things, to realize the conventional ultimate bodhicitta. Compared to avoiding the objects of your afflictions, it is more important to probe within. So here, of course, what we're talking about is confronting the mental afflictions versus simply avoiding situations that cause the mental afflictions to arise. So the first one is more important, to confront the mental afflictions rather than avoiding situations. But of course, there is a time and place to avoid difficult situations. And I think I already mentioned this before, is that if there are certain people or things or situations that always overwhelm us in a negative way, then an effective short-term strategy can be to not allow ourselves to unnecessarily enter into those situations, because they're just going to overwhelm us in a negative way. Of course, this is never an effective long-term strategy, as we see here. But there may be circumstances where the best thing to do is not enter into that situation if we know it's simply going to overwhelm us in a negative way, if we don't have the capacity to take that adverse condition into the path. Then we can, of course, work on ourselves so that later we can take advantage of that difficult situation and be able to take it into the path. And then let's go on to the next one, which is also a list of six things. It says, do not apply misplaced understanding. So here, there are particular ideas and words and concepts that we easily can misunderstand. So here, it lists six things which, if we're doing in a wrong way, and how to do it in a correct way. This refers to the avoidance of six misplaced understandings. If instead of enduring hardships entailed in Dharma practice, you forbear difficulties when seeking the objects of your desire, nurturing friends and subduing your foes, this is misplaced forbearance. So misplaced forbearance is to forbear in trying to get the objects of desire, in seeking the objects of desire. So often we actually are pretty good at this. We often have a lot of perseverance in trying to get our objects of our desire. But then when we're faced with a little bit of hardship in Dharma practice, we just give it up. So this is misplaced forbearance, you know, having a lot of perseverance and forbearance striving for the sense pleasures. Rather, we should have more striving, perseverance and forbearance in terms of our Dharma practice. So that would be correct forbearance. If instead of aspiring to purifying your negative karma as much as you can, accumulate merit as much as you can, and arrive and strive to transform your thoughts as much as you can, you view the excellences of this life as admirable qualities and aspire to them, this is misplaced aspiration. So misplaced aspiration is, again, aspiring to the eight worldly concerns, hoping that money and pleasure and praise and good reputation are going to fulfill us. So correct aspiration, of course, is the aspiration to transform our mind. Instead of savoring your experience of Dharma through striving in learning, reflection, and meditation, you savor the taste of sensual desire and pursue it. You will dwell and you dwell and relish memories of past sexual experiences and triumphs over enemies. This is misplaced savoring. So same thing again. If we savor sensual desire, this is misplaced savoring. So rather, we should savor hearing, contemplating, and meditating instead. If instead of cultivating compassion for those caught in suffering and its conditions, you have compassion for those who undergo sufferings as part of their ascetic life and meditative pursuit, this is misplaced compassion. So misplaced compassion is compassion for those who are actually putting effort into spiritual practice and who actually seem to coming up against some hardship, rather than having compassion for those who are actually in suffering. So correct compassion, of course, is to have compassion for those suffering. Not having compassion seeing people actually putting effort into the spiritual practice. If instead of cultivating dedication to Dharma practice as a privilege, you have a sense of dedication to such endeavors as accumulating material wealth, nurturing friends, and pursuing mundane greatness, this is misplaced dedication. So same thing again here. Dedicating ourselves to the eight worldly concerns, dedicating ourselves to making more money, more pleasure, and so forth, is misplaced dedication. Rather, correct dedication is to dedicate to Dharma practice, to transforming our mind. If instead of rejoicing in those from the Buddhas to the sentient beings who engage in virtue and enjoy its fruit happiness, you rejoice when misfortunes and disasters befall your adversaries, this is misplaced rejoicing. So again, if we're rejoicing in the misfortunes of others, this is misplaced rejoicing. Rather, we should rejoice in the virtues of others. You should relate to these six misplaced understandings with appropriate avoidance and affirmation. So, again, instead of the misplaced understanding, we engage in the correct understanding. So, we're on page 22 now. Do not be sporadic. So, of course, as with anything, sporadic meaning you don't have continuous effort. You do a bit of effort and you stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop. Sporadic means not continuous. So here, do not be sporadic. And so as we understand in everything in life, the key to success is continuity. And this is what I think is going to be said in the commentary here. There's a question, though. You had a question?
Oh, yeah, it was just a general... Why is it so easy to do all the things which are not so virtuous? It's so easy to get drunk or hang out with friends, talking nonsense.
This is the work of life.
Doing all
the
stuff which is not virtuous.
This is the work of life.
Habit. Habit? No, well, habit, yeah. It's habit plus the influences around us. So two things. We have strong habit plus the conditions around us are also, unfortunately, our modern society is facilitating this easily. You'll find, in fact, some of the things that we get into habit back home, we don't have here, do we? We don't have the habit here of going down to the pub and getting drunk with friends, do we? Because the conditions are not there. So there's two things. It's habit plus external conditions.
So it will get easier if
exactly.
Progress more
exactly.
In the circumstances. But then it's not such a virtuous Dharma practice anymore if our life gets easier because everything is attuned to the Dharma practice. Because taking on this hard practice and taking those adversaries is good Dharma practice. So.
Right, and therefore, as we progress, we will be able to take even more and more hardships into the path. As a beginner, we won't be able to take them all, of course. The little ones we might be able to take into the path. And so as we progress, we'll be able to take more and more and more and more, bigger and bigger and bigger hardships into the path.
Which itself means it doesn't get easier.
It does. It gets easier.
I'm curious.
You have to
guide yourself. Yeah, step by step.
Because the more that we progress, the less self-cherishing, self-grasping. And it's self-cherishing, self-grasping, which sees it as a hardship.
Damn it.
Why?
Yeah, that's just because I still see a lot of it as kind of a hardship, which tells me a lot about self-grasping.
Sure. I mean, again, don't have this unrealistic expectation. You know, this is something we'll need to work on for the rest of our life. It's not like by next week, next month, it's going to be sorted. It won't be. No. So therefore, have a long-term perspective, and every little step we take is an improvement in our life. Yeah. Again, have that long-term perspective. Okay. So let's have a look at the commentary on do not be sporadic. At times you practice mind training, while at other times you engage in mantra repetitions. On some occasions you forsake both, yet on other occasions you guard both. Relinquish such a sporadic approach. Forsake also such sporadic approaches as sometimes making plans for this mundane life and increasing negative karma and afflictions, and sometimes engaging in Dharma practice for the sake of future lives. Without being sporadic, engage in Dharma practice with single-pointed dedication. In particular, practicing mind training, for mind training in the innermost essence is the innermost essence of Dharma practice. So again, this is often what happens, is that people put little spurts of effort. They do some effort and then they stop. Effort and stop. And then, of course, they don't really notice any improvement because they're not being... And so then they eventually even give up because they're not making progress, because they're not being continuous. But if we can really have that continuity, then we can really start to make some progress and change. So very good advice here. And similar to this, the next one is train with decisiveness. And this is, I don't know, I understand the meaning of the first line, but it's obviously some old Tibetan understanding. When a minor nerve is damaged, you treat it by cutting it clean. I'm not exactly sure what that's supposed to imply, but in the same way, when you engage in training of mind, do not remain hesitant, but direct your entire mind. You should remain resolute in your decision and train with no hesitation. Avoid such dilettantish, okay, attitudes as, first I will check to see if mind training is beneficial, if not, I will recite mantras. This indicates you have failed to let go of yearning for self-centered happiness. This kind of practice can't even overcome sickness and malevolent possession. So here again is to really have this decisive attitude, to really put effort into the practice. So again, one way we can really be decisive is really reflect on the benefits, develop deep aspiration to do the practice, and we will put a lot of effort into the practice. The next verse says, be released through the two, investigation and analysis. And so here is some very good practical advice. It says, first, investigate which affliction is most dominant in your mind and earnestly apply its specific antidote, striving hard to subdue the affliction. Then analyze the way deluded mental projections arise in relation to objects and act as their basis. By applying the antidotes, you reduce the force of the afflictions and prevent their arising. By repeatedly thinking, from here on, I will never allow my mind stream to be tainted by these afflictions. You must cultivate familiarity with the protective armor for the future. Thus, with these twin methods for applying antidotes to past and future afflictions, strive diligently to eliminate the afflictions. So here we have these two mental factors, investigation and analysis. And here the way they are applied is investigation is first we investigate what is our dominant mental affliction and really work on reducing that. Because for many of us, most of us, there's one mental affliction that dominates, whether it's craving or jealousy or anger or anxiety or whatever it is. There's usually one mental affliction that really dominates us. So here it says, search that out and work to reduce it, because it's really creating us a lot of damage and harm. Then it says to analyze the way deluded mental projections arise in relation to objects that act as their bases. So here we can talk about there are three factors which lead to a mental affliction. You need all three factors for a mental affliction to arise. You need the seed, which is the habit. You need an object. And you need here this inappropriate attention, which here is saying the way deluded mental projections arise. So what it's suggesting here is that to have a look at how the process of how we attend to things in an inappropriate way. So we need the seed, for example, of anger. We need an object, and then we need to be looking at that object in a wrong way for any mental affliction such as anger to arise. And so what it's suggesting here is to have a look at the mechanism by which we attend to these in an inappropriate way. And if we can see how we are looking at the object in an inappropriate way and correct that, then the mental affliction cannot arise. And one way we have this inappropriate attention is when we looked at that illusory-like emptiness, is that when we see an object that's unpleasant, we automatically attend to it as if the ugliness is in the object. Or if it's a pleasant object, we attend to it as if the pleasantness or the beauty is in the object. And so by seeing this way of looking at it inappropriately, then we can overcome the mental affliction arising. So that's what's being said here, is that these twin methods, first by really investigating, see which is the main mental affliction now that dominates our mind and creates problems, and reduce that as much as possible. And then in general, look at the way in which how we attend to things in an inappropriate way that gives rise to the mental afflictions. And if we can see that way of inappropriately attending to things, we can stop the mental afflictions from arising. Okay. Yeah.
We went through the antidotes of the main mental afflictions.
A little bit. I mentioned earlier today, like anger was patience, attachment was impermanence, pride also impermanence, jealousy, rejoicing. So that's just some examples.
And craving?
Well, craving is attachment. So again, it's impermanence is the recommended one normally. Okay, we'll keep going then. Do not boast of your good deeds. So again here, classic spiritual ego. Do not be boastful and arrogant towards others on any grounds, suggesting, for example, that another person is indebted to you or that you engage in certain spiritual practices or that you are learned and that you are industrious in your ethical discipline, or that you are great, or that your family lineage is excellent. Rādhrīṅpa has said, don't place too much hope in humans, supplicate the gods instead.
What kind of gods?
Here, well, we can talk about external, the Buddha, or more really internal, our Buddha nature, our own Buddha nature.
But why do you say gods?
Oh, because he's using common language here. Because the common people talk about gods and demons. So he's using that metaphor to explain the practice to the common people that, you know, that the gods and the demons are really inside of ourselves, not some god or demon out there. The demons are the mental afflictions, and the god is the cherishing others and our Buddha nature and so forth. In any case, if you have correctly distinguished between enemy and friend, you understand everyone to be a friend. Then even when you work for others' welfare, the jaundice of self-centeredness does not arise. Instead, you recognize all such tasks as obligations, so boastfulness towards others simply does not occur. At this point, your mind has become trained. So again here, that if we really boasting about the good things we do, again, it's the ego's hijacked our spiritual practice. We just become spiritual ego, and we're just boosting the self-cherishing. Do not be ill-tempered. Whatever others may have done to you in the past, such as humiliating you or verbally abusing you, the blame lies within yourself. The blame for our own suffering lies within ourself, lies within our self-grasping, self-cherishing. Do not react to others with contorted facial expressions or abusive words. Even with your mind, restrain yourself from ill-temperedness. Because again, ill-temperedness is really a reaction, and it's really all to do with cognitive fusion and, of course, self-cherishing as well. Because your Dharma practice has not yet become an antidote to self-grasping, your resilience is at present weak. You are volatile due to ill-temperedness. Since such behavior makes your Dharma practice ineffective, ensure that your Dharma practice becomes an antidote to self-grasping. So I think this is pretty straightforward here. Maybe we can have a look at, I think Alan Wallace has something here. Let's have a look. When someone else, I think this is that the right one? Yes, is that okay? When someone else is abused, we are often not troubled. But when we ourselves are abused, self-centeredness tends to raise its head, and our response is far more passionate. The mind training encourages us not to retaliate verbally or harbour resentment when we are abused or slandered, but rather counteract our own self-centeredness, the true cause of our distress in such situations. We don't have much control over anger arising in the first place, but once we notice anger, we have a choice. Even if everything else in our practice is perfect, if we choose to feed resentment, contempt, or self-righteousness, this unwinds the whole ball of yarn of our mind training. Therefore, don't be bound by distemper or resentment. The most direct way to free yourself from anger is not to identify with it. So again, one method we can use here is if some anger or so forth is arising, is just use mindfulness to observe it. Observe it arise and pass. Do not identify with it. Just see it as an object arising in the mind. Then it can't take hold of our mind. Then the next verse. Do not be fickle. This means not displaying erratic responses to every situation out of a transient temperament. This causes great inconvenience to your companions and must therefore be relinquished. So again here, be consistent in our behaviour, in the way in which we respond. Do not be boisterous. So again here, I think this is sort of the spiritual ego here. Avoid seeking fame and praise through expressions of gratitude for assistance you may have rendered others or benefit you may have brought them. In brief, do not desire even to hear compliments for help or assistance rendered to others. So this is really a measure of how our mind training practice is going. If we help others, and we saw this in the 8 verses of mind training, is that if we help others, then of course often we expect something in return, even if it's just merely thank you. So a check that our self-cherishing is reducing is that if we help others and they're not replying in terms of being grateful or gratitude, and in fact, even if they're doing something negative towards us and we don't react to that, that's a very good sign that the self-cherishing is really reducing. Okay, then now we have a little bit of a summary of the text. In this manner, you should train your entire life in the 2 awakening minds by means of both meditative sessions and practices in the subsequent periods. So remember again here, any practice has 2 parts: meditation and what we do for the rest of the day. We need to integrate that into daily life. So here, of course, the 2 main practices are the 2 awakening minds, the 2 minds of bodhicitta, the mind of exchanging self with others, and the ultimate bodhicitta of the wisdom of emptiness. So we are to meditate, internalize, and integrate into daily life. There will then be no basis for dispute and no reason for conflict with the gods, demons, or your fellow humans. Here the word God can mean simply within the desire realm, and we see that on that wheel of life chart there. We can talk about what's called the 6 realms of existence, or 6 types of existences, and it's described on that chart, on the picture on the wall there. Of course, we are very familiar with the human realm and also quite familiar with the animal realm. But then we can talk about these 2 types of existences called Deva and Asura in Sanskrit, And these two types of existences tend to have very subtle type bodies, live long lives, and really have immense pleasure and very little suffering. And so often then this word deva is translated as God realm, but again, nothing to do with the Christian idea of a creator God. Simply God in terms of having a very pleasurable existence and very little suffering. But of course, this will also come to an end. And asuras are very similar to devas. And then preta and narak realms are two types of existences that tend to have quite a lot of physical suffering. And particularly narak realm have a lot of suffering. And so therefore this word narak is sometimes translated as hell realm. But again, not the same idea as the Christian idea of a hell. So these are the six types of existences. So sometimes in the text, when it uses the word God, it's talking about these types of beings here in these realms.
Where does the hungry ghost belong to?
It's this preta is sometimes translated as hungry ghost. Okay, so where were we? Yes, down the bottom. By making the gods at peace and serpentine nagas. So nagas is one of the beings, types of beings in this preta realm. Tranquil and everyone happy as best as possible. When your last breath approaches, you will experience the beginning of true happiness and you will turn your back on misery and travel from light to light, from joy to joy. So often you see that term of traveling light to light, joy to joy, means that because we have led a wholesome life, we've had an ethical lifestyle, we've done the best we can, then that will set us up for a good future rebirth. So we'll go, and if we keep doing that life after life, then we'll go from light to light, joy to joy, and then eventually we'll transcend this cycle of existence altogether. The effects or benefits of these spiritual practices is presented in the following. Through this proliferation of the five degenerations, transform every event into the path of enlightenment. So here in the commentary, we're going to see what's called the five degenerations. And often in Buddhism, we hear that it's said that we live in degenerate times. And so there are five ways in which we can talk about that. We can talk about the degenerate time. It's a degenerate time, and this means a time where there is a lot of conflict in the world, a lot of sickness and illness, and also sort of spiritual poverty, a materialistic approach. And I think we can really see that in the modern world. We have very much this materialistic approach, and that there is a lot of sickness and poverty and conflict in the world today. So that's what degenerate time means. And then we talk about degenerate lifespan, that actually the lifespan is decreasing. But of course, in the very immediate past, we see that actually, in general, the lifespan has been increasing. Although now I think there are some studies showing that actually we may be, due to various factors, starting to go the other way. That's what I've read recently. That this generation may be the first generation whereby the lifespan's less than the previous because of various factors.
Junk food.
Well, that's one of them, yes. And then the third one is degenerate view. Again, a tendency towards wrong views. And we can see this a lot, I think, in the modern society in terms of turning away from even ethics and so forth. And then, of course, the degeneration of the mental afflictions. And we see this quite a lot in the modern society. You know, we've, of course, made a lot of technological progress. So in many of the modern societies, the physical suffering has been reduced quite a lot, which is good. But at the same time, often the mental suffering has increased exponentially. So here, it's to do a lot with that the mental afflictions are increasing in our modern world. And that seems to really be the case. And then the last degeneration. Is sentient beings themselves. And here again, we're just talking about suffering and mental afflictions in general. So it's very much related to this. So these are what's called the five degenerations. So let's have a read about what these are here in the commentary. Generally speaking, the teaching of Buddha Shakyamuni emerged during an era when the five degenerations were on the rise. In particular, it has emerged during this present age, the era of the last 500-year cycle, when the degenerations are even more severe than the five degenerations. Okay. So they often talk, you hear about this 500-year cycle in terms of the main practices of ethics, concentration and wisdom, and how much people are practicing them. So they talk about these going through these 500-year cycles, and then eventually these teachings will disappear from this world. Because of this, sentient beings have only afflictions in their thoughts and only negative karma for their actions. They relish when others suffer and feel anguished when others are fortunate. So with all three doors, body, speech and mind, sentient beings indulge only in deeds that are harmful to others. It is therefore an era when harmful sentient beings have gathered. Furthermore, those non-human agents that admire the positive white force have departed to the pure realms to benefit the bodhisattvas, whereas the strength and force of those who admire the dark side have increased. Sounds a bit like Star Wars, doesn't it? Because of this, the misfortunes plague sentient beings. Today, therefore, a multitude of adverse conditions cause all kinds of suffering for sentient beings, and myriad obstacles particularly befall those who put the doctrine into practice. So this is a bit of an answer also why it's so easy for us to engage in negative behaviour and it's so difficult to engage in positive behaviour. So at this time, when adverse conditions compete to form a thicket, if you do not train in the spiritual practice, though you may enter other systems of practice, you will fail to succeed in Dharma practice. Again, because adverse conditions seem to be on the rise, and if we have no way of bringing adverse conditions into the path, then we're not going to be able to progress in whatever spiritual path we're following. By entering this practice and striving in it, on the other hand, you will transform all adverse conditions in factors conducive for training on the path to enlightenment. As for other benefits, a year's pursuit of virtuous activity during this age, when the teaching of the Buddha faces hostile threats, will help accomplish the accumulations better than eons pursuing virtuous activities in purer realms. So, and we can sort of understand that, is that that if we can do good actions in the face of difficult situations, that's, of course, much more powerful than if we do the same equivalent actions when it's easy to do them. So we can sort of appreciate that. So actually, if we can manage to take adverse conditions into the path, we can actually accelerate the path because of the power of doing those positive actions even in the face of difficult situations. That will create a much more powerful imprint in our mind. Therefore, those capable of training the mind are not vulnerable to the proliferation of the five degenerations and remain contented. If you know how to train the mind, even your body, the body of a mind-training yogi, is known as a city that is a source of joy. For all happiness of this and future lives, of self and others, comes about on the basis of this very body. Strive, therefore, by concentrating all your efforts in this endeavor. If you make sure that the teachings are integrated with your mind, that the rule of Dharma is established as firmly as a state driven through your heart, okay, and that you experience the taste of Dharma, before long you will attain the perfect state, wherein the complete aims of self and others are accomplished. Thus said the master, again Geshe Chikawa. To illustrate these points in a definitive formulation, the author himself wrote the following line. So again, this is from Geshe Chikawa himself. Because of my numerous aspirations, I have defied the tragic tale of suffering and have taken instructions to subdue self-grasping. Now, even if death comes, I have no regrets. So I think also if we do our best here to subdue self-grasping and cherish others, I think also when death comes for us, we can have no regrets. We've made our life most meaningful. These words were uttered as an expression of joy by the highly accomplished yogi Chikawa, who, having presented the method of practice, arrived at a decisively settled state of mind following a clear discrimination between enemy and friend.
What is this white force which they talk about in this paragraph?
Again, it's just talking about those beings in the world who are trying to pursue virtue and trying to help others versus beings in the world who are engaging in harmful, negative behavior.
So they would be in a subtle...
Yeah, so they're saying here that a lot of these beings are not really present in our world at the moment. Rather, they're saying there's a lot of beings present who are more... trying to create harm than good. That's what's being suggested here.
And we're talking about subtle beings.
Yeah, not human beings. Of course, we can talk about human beings as well, but here they're talking about these other types of beings.
You can compare Donald Trump maybe to that.
I'd like to finish the text here by reading a little bit from Alan Wallace's book, again. But before I do, actually, is there any questions about any of the points we've covered so far? Because now we've come to the end of the text.
Is exposition, does that mean talking?
Exposition, teaching.
That's teaching.
Exposition means teaching. You know, listening and reading. Any other questions? Yeah.
So they believe that the 500-year cycle is going towards...
Going downhill, yes.
Downhill?
Yeah. I've seen it explained a couple of different ways. And they sometimes talk about the three main practices, ethics, concentration, wisdom, that, and I can't remember exactly, but the cycle went more than 500 years. Yeah. But it was like in the first 500-year cycle, there are a lot of beings practicing wisdom and achieving the result. In the next 500 years, it was less. And then in the third cycle, something like a lot were practicing concentration and samadhi, and then less. And then in the next 500, there was more, a lot of ethics, and then eventually even ethics wasn't being practiced. So it was sort of like going backwards like that in each 500 year. And there are different assertions. One, I saw that it was after a period of 2,500-3,000 years that it would be. So, of course, we're approaching that now, 2,500 years since the Buddha first appeared on the planet. But there are different assertions about these 500-year cycles, but in general, they're presented as in each subsequent 500-year cycle, things are sort of going downhill, basically, going backwards in terms of spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And then eventually that this would disappear completely from this world. That's the assertion.
And we'll all be stuck in...
And of course, within Buddhist cosmology, There is not just life on this planet, but life on many planets. And of course, they talk about multiple systems, multiple universes. So, of course, this is not the only place where we could be reborn on this planet. There are many other things as well. Yeah.
This sounds pretty grim for our times when we look at it, but if you look from a slightly different angle, there are so many things which give hope, like
sure.
The Dharma has never been so widespread
sure.
as right now. Never before so many people had access to all the bases we need. And even looking at our society, even that there's so much depression
sure,
and
sure,
so as,
sure.
This is always a cause for starting spiritual practice.
Sure.
So I see when I'm
exactly.
depressed, I'm like, okay, I feel your suffering, but it's a possibility. So there's a lot of hope, I just don't
know. Exactly. Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. And that's what's being said here a little bit. When you're faced with hardship, and we saw that earlier, that can generate a mind of wishing to overcome that suffering. And so, and I think that's what we're finding, is that we've had a lot of material progress, but mental progress has gone backwards. And because of a lot of that mental suffering, now in the modern world, people are looking for a solution, you know. Taking some pills is not really going to do the job. And so they're looking for alternatives. And of course, that's exactly what you see, is a lot of people are now looking for some sustainable way of actually improving mental health. And I think modern society hasn't really got anything much to offer there apart from some medication to sort of numb the pain, basically.
I mean, that's why we are here, I guess.
Yeah, well, sure.
The Jewish philosophy, the Kabbalah, if you know what's...
About, I've heard of it, I don't, haven't studied, of course.
Say the same.
Yeah.
The same, totally
yeah.
the same. It is the deeper
sure,
in
yeah,
the
yeah,
in
yeah.
the Bible to understand, they said, totally the same.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, even in Islam they say the same as well.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah I mean, of course...
Even in Islam they say the same as well, like everyone is just going, it's going downhill.
Yeah.
I have some trouble to compare today with 2,500 years ago, because we were many population at that time, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So resources were unlimited, and a lot of things were different compared to today.
Sure,
today we
exactly.
are overreaching the resources.
Of course, absolutely, exactly, exactly.
It's
of course.
But you said, like in the first course I was with you, you said that there is like two forces.
Yeah.
And it's just need a little bit of a shifting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And that goes on your point, is this, I think I already mentioned this tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
That because of, generally, because of necessity, because of mental suffering, it's forcing people to broaden their perspective, their perspective, their worldview, and a more global worldview. And like I said, we need, history has shown there's been a couple of periods in the past where we've gone to another level of worldview, improved, and we're on the cusp of this one now, of going to this more global worldview rather than this sort of culture-centered view, you know, us versus them sort of thing, which is at the moment destroying our planet, of course. And this person was saying that we need to get to this 10% mark very quickly. Otherwise, we're going to destroy the planet. But he said we're close. So we just need to nudge up to the 10%, and that's going to be the critical mass that will have a flow-on effect to the rest of society. So I think this is desperately needed.
So I have a question. Like, all those enlightened humans, they meant this for happiness of all human beings,
mm-hmm.
of all sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
So if, like, during time, like, just...
During
time,
oh.
there are, like, more enlightened beings, yeah? So just, like, logically, it has to become, like, better. So why it's worse?
Why does it have to be... It has to become better.
Because they became enlightened.
Right.
Enlightened. In order to make everybody happy. So
they can't make them happy. They can only offer them help. An enlightened person can't wave their magic wand and fix everything. So it's up to us whether we can actually even see them to to be able to benefit, and whether we benefit or not. And if we don't, of course, things go downhill. So an enlightened being from their side has no power to dispel our suffering, apart from giving us advice and guidance and support and inspiration. That's all they can do. If they could do more, then yes, I think it should be that the fact that everything should be improving, because the more enlightened being, more waving magic wands and less suffering would happen. But the reality is that we have to fix our own problems. You know, that's the reality.
What's the relationship between the tantric Vajrayana practitioners and the very subtle enlightened...
Very subtle enlightened what?
I don't know, consciousness that...
Well, of course, in Tantra or Vajrayana, we're trying to gain access to that very subtle mind, which is the Dharmakaya. So, see, in Theravada and Mahayana, there's no talk about this at all. It's just the mind we have. We're just refining that with the shamatha practice. And then when we eliminate all the mental afflictions, that mind becomes the enlightened mind. Whereas in Tantra Vajrayana, we say that, well, actually, there's these levels of mind, and that the Dharmakaya, enlightened mind, is this very subtle mind, and we need to gain access to that and rest in that, and that will become the enlightened mind.
But they don't have access to, they don't have a communication with the non-human...
Yeah, I mean, the other types of beings, if we purify our mind, whether it's at the level of Tantra or the normal level... And this doesn't have to be a Buddhist practice. Again, it was a bit like the clairvoyance idea, is that simply if we train our mind, particularly through the shamatha practice, we can start to have this ability. But also, of course, through the vipassana practice, when we realize emptiness and start to eliminate the mental afflictions from our mind, also we begin to have the capacity to be able to communicate with other, see other beings and communicate with other beings.
And how do they... What's the advantage of doing that for the tantric people?
Well, one is that sometimes these beings can guide us and help us. And, of course, another way is then we can help them because we can communicate with them. We can teach them and so forth, as a Arya Bodhisattva, for example. So we can both receive teachings if they're more advanced, or if they're not, we can help them. Sorry?
Why?
Yeah.
They don't think it's a teaching from Buddha?
So remember, Buddha taught many different things in many different places. And from those teachings, we have the different philosophical systems forming and spreading. So the teachings that spread to the Theravada countries were only these Pali-based teachings, the Four Noble Truths and so forth. So even the Sanskrit-based teachings of the Emptiness and Perfection of Wisdom Sutras didn't spread to those countries. So often in those countries, they would also say that even those teachings are not the teaching of the Buddha. And certainly Tantra never made it to those countries, so they would generally say that also Tantra is not the teaching of the Buddha. And in certain Mahayana countries, I think also they maybe would accept that Tantra is not the teaching of Buddha. So it depends which systems that spread to those countries, what their assertions is. But regardless of what tradition we're following, of course, as I've mentioned a number of times, is that we need to just check out what we are reading and contemplating and make sure that it's something that is beneficial and makes sense and so forth, and then we can follow that. And then, of course, as we progress in the spiritual path, then, of course, we'll be able to validate through our own experience the various teachings, whether they're, in fact, they're accurate or not, or helpful or not. But I think often in the Theravada traditions, they would say that the Mahayana and Vajrayana were not the teachings of the original Buddha, because that's not what spread there. But anyway, if that's the case or not, in terms of our practice, we just follow the advice of the Buddha himself. You know, check it out, see whether it's helps, it's beneficial, and whether it's valid or not. But generally, this is, I think, what the assertion is in the Theravada's traditions.
Is there something about it in the sutras?
Sorry?
Can we find something in the sutras about Tantra? Or...
Sutra and Tantra are two different systems of practice. So you won't see Tantra in Sutra and so vice versa. So Tantra is not mentioned in Sutra because they're different teachings from the Buddha. So you won't find reference to Tantra in Sutras generally. There's Sutra and Tantra as the two systems. And then, of course, within Sutra, you get Pali and Sanskrit sutras.
Yeah, from the point of view of Mahayana, Theravada may look a little bit egoistic because they don't say, I practice for the benefit of all sentient beings. No, I practice for myself. I want this nirvana for myself, and then when I reach nirvana, I will look around and see, I will help to this one, and maybe for that one, not for everybody.
Yeah. So, a couple of things to mention there. One is the Theravada, the philosophical system that it's based on, is a philosophical system that says when we achieve nirvana and then this body finishes, end of story. Finished. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, to even have the idea of wishing to liberate all sentient beings from samsara doesn't make any sense. Because we've got maybe 20, 30, 40 years from when we become an arhat to when we die. I mean, how would you ever think about trying to liberate all sentient beings when you've, in 20 or 30, I mean, it's just nonsensical. Mm-hmm. So it never even comes into their thought, that thought, because according to their philosophical system, that's not even a possibility. It's crazy to think that. But at the same time, we shouldn't think that someone who's following that path is selfish, because you will not achieve nirvana with self-centered attitude, putting yourself above others. That even there, of course, they're developing the four immeasurables, loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings. So also at that level, while they're striving for nirvana, they would be having loving kindness and compassion for all sentient beings and doing whatever they can to help them. Of course. But of course, they would not take it to the next step and say, I'm going to make it my personal responsibility to liberate everyone from suffering. Because that would be a crazy idea based on the understanding that when they become an arhat and the end of that life, then it's finished. Then that idea. So they never take it to the next level. But of course, even at that level of practice, we're cultivating loving kindness and compassion to all living beings, and we're trying to help all living beings as much as we can. If we have the self-cherishing, putting ourselves above others, I think we're not even going to get anywhere near nirvana. Mm-hmm. It's just that they don't take it to the next step of bodhicitta, the altruistic intention that we find in the Mahayana. Because in the Mahayana, the basis, the philosophical system that's a basis is when we achieve enlightenment, we'll keep coming back again and again and again to help. So therefore, it makes sense to make that aspiration with that understanding.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and second question. It always sounds a little bit funny for me, like to help all sentient beings. Like I go near the cow and there are a lot of flies which are sucking blood from the cow.
Sure.
How I'm supposed to help the cow or to these flies or mosquitoes and everybody, because they are all sentient beings.
Right. Yeah. And the way, of course, we can help sentient beings is to teach them. And, of course, therefore, we can make aspirations to meet with sentient beings who are able to benefit from those teachings. Mm. Of course, as a fly or something, there's not much we can do to help. No,
yeah, exactly.
Of course.
Like lion, chasing a buffalo eating it.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Come help. Yeah. If I help the buffalo, lion will die out of hunger. Hmm.
So again, in all of our life, we're going to be faced with very tough ethical situations where we use wisdom and compassion, and we decide what best to do.
Yeah.
As we saw earlier, that whatever we do in our life, there will be harm. So we just try to reduce that as much as possible, and we try to benefit as much as possible. That's all we can do. That's all we can do. Okay. Now, just to conclude this text, I want to read from Alan Wallace's book here. And he says, The key to spiritual maturation is transforming all of life, adversity included, into spiritual practice. The seven-point mind training, a synthesis of teaching and practices developed over hundreds of years during the flowering of Indian Buddhist civilization, is wonderfully effective for cultivating the two bodhicittas during the course of an active way of life. No method other than embracing all of life, adversity, suffering, and joy, will be effective when there are so many obstacles to spiritual practice. And now he's talking about, again, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. So Dilgo Khyentse, again, was one of the greatest modern-day masters in the Nyingma tradition, and he was a very high-level Dzogchen practitioner. And he says, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's final teaching, he passed away about 20 years ago, I think. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's final teaching to his Western students was the seven-point mind training. He was a master of the profound teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Yet of all the teachings he knew, this mind training was what he most wanted to leave us with. In his own words, so now he's quoting from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who said, "There exist many teachings, profound and vast, such as Mahamudra and Dzogchen, but our capacity is small. We are without perseverance and lack sufficient respect and devotion to be freed through teachings such as these. Nevertheless, if we practice this mind training, we will experience great benefits. It is an extraordinary instruction, the very essence of the Bodhisattva teachings, and has been praised again and again. Therefore, let us practice it without distraction." And then back to Alan Wallace, he says, "This was the final testimony of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche." So maybe it could be useful, this mind training. So that's the text finished. We've still got 5 or 10 minutes to go if there's any more questions from anything. Yes?
If you're following the Theravada tradition when they're doing impermanent suffering and no self.
Sure.
Say all paths lead to the same thing again.
Exactly.
Will you get to a realization of emptiness just by following that anyway, without realizing you're practicing emptiness?
Yeah. As I've said a couple of times, I think, in this course, is forget about no self, even realizing subtle impermanence, we're very close. If we got a sharp mind, I think we can make that transition. And also, in a number of the classic Indian texts on Mahayana and to do with emptiness, particularly like, for example, Chandrakirti is one of the classic Indian texts that we study in terms of emptiness practice. In there, at the beginning, he goes to great length to show how emptiness is actually taught in the Pali scriptures. And he quotes a number of Pali sutras where he says, look, there the Buddha taught it. Not obvious, but it's there. So he even goes to the point of saying that actually the teaching is there, but not in its fully explained form because people couldn't appreciate, but the Buddha did teach these ideas even in the Pali scriptures. So he's saying that it's actually even there. But of course, if we are following the path, Theravada path, and we're realizing in subtle impermanence and dukkha and no self and purifying the mind, then of course, if emptiness is really how things exist, I think that person will get to that point through their experience, regardless of whatever scriptures are saying from their tradition. So there's a difference between the underlying philosophical system versus the practitioner. So I think whatever philosophical system we're following, if it's limited or it's partial, we will at some point transcend it.
Because the emptiness practice here seems very direct. Very, very direct.
Sure.
Is it seen in that way? Is it a more direct way to do it?
What do you mean by more direct way?
Or rather than meditating on impermanence, you go straight to emptiness.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, this practice of emptiness, one, of course, is if we don't have any some sort of shamatha, we can meditate on emptiness a lot and not really get anywhere. And two, I think that it's very easy for this emptiness practice to be misinterpreted, not even have an experience of emptiness and misinterpret that. And certainly, we can sort of mouth the words easily, you know, everything lacks independent existence. And superficially, we can go, yeah, yeah, I know that. But when it really comes to our experience, that middle way path between the two extremes is very narrow. And it's so easy to slide into the extreme of either grasping or into nihilism. And so, as I said, one thing that can really help us is not only impermanence, but the realization of no self. If we really have those as a basis for this experience of emptiness, I think it's more easy to stay on that middle way between, without sliding to those extremes as well. So I think it can be a very helpful basis for the emptiness practice. So we shouldn't really underestimate that.
Can non-self, then, the realization of non-self, be seen as the same as saying emptiness?
Yeah, again, you know, we can talk about no self at a number of levels, but I think if we're very sharp in the way we investigate, and even if we investigate looking for the self based on the sort of the no-self scriptures, I think we can still come to the realization of emptiness if we really are very sharp in our investigation. So regardless of what the initial scriptures and texts are saying in terms of the practice, us as an individual practitioner, even following that, we can come to that experience. Because even in the Mahayana, you know, in this course we looked at the shamatha practices with Renato, the observing the mind and resting in awareness. They're just shamatha practices, but also there, it's even well known that someone of sharp faculty, even just resting in awareness or looking at the mind, can intuitively have an experience of emptiness.
Just seeing everything, you're noticing everything pop up and just pass by, aren't you?
Exactly. Again, if we have a very sharp sort of mind, simply doing that, which is just shamatha practice, we can come to an intuitive insight into emptiness.
I was going to say that, because as you're watching the breath, you're realizing it's impermanent. It's,
sure.
It's different every single time. Sure. Same as the mind. Every sure. thought, everything comes through it is different every single time. It's
exactly. Quite, and like I said, I think if we really appreciate what really impermanence really means at the very subtle level, we're so close to emptiness. So close. So close.
For the right understanding, conceptual meditation is a meditation using the power...
Conceptual meditation? You mean analytical? What do you mean by conceptual meditation?
The one which uses the power of thought, like analyzing...
Yeah, analytical meditation, yeah.
Isn't it called conceptual? No. Isn't there a non-conceptual? Maybe
no, we can, in our Vipassana practice, we can, in our investigation, come to a conceptual experience of emptiness, or a non-conceptual, but necessarily, initially, it will be conceptual, because our mind is not stable and clear enough to be non-conceptual.
So conception would be I'm using the power of thought.
No. It's not a discursive thing. Here, when we talk about a conceptual experience of emptiness, is that we are experiencing emptiness via an image. It's called generic image. So in that experience, there's a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing emptiness, the object.
Okay.
So it's not a discursive thinking experience. There's no thinking going on. It's just that we are realizing emptiness by way of this generic image, and hence it's called conceptual, because it's not non-dualistic. But it's not thinking. We're not thinking at that stage.
But in an analytical meditation...
Meditation.
It would be using the power of thoughts to discern... For example, okay, everything is transient because I can see this and that happening.
Well, we're using some concepts and intellect as a basis for our investigation. But then, of course, the investigation is we are observing directly. Because otherwise we're not investigating reality. So we are observing directly based on some way of observing that. So we have some... You know, like for impermanence, we have some intellectual understanding of looking at the transient nature. So we use that understanding to observe, to see that everything's changing moment by moment, but that observation is direct.
If you come to the point of realization, it will become direct.
Well, because the realization, the realization initially of impermanence or emptiness is not thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, you come to a point of some realization, but that realization is via what's called a generic image. You have sort of an image of emptiness that you are realizing. And it's a valid experience, but it's not yet direct and non-conceptual. We have to go deeper to get through that, to break through that generic image.
And the Vipassana we did here is more a conceptual approach, or we did it on a conceptual kind of level. We are still observing.
When we do the investigation, there are a number of ways to investigate. And one way to investigate is through logical reasoning, which is what we presented in those four essential points. So you can use a logical reasoning approach to come to determine conclusively that there's no me to be found. So that's a more discursive approach. And that's what we did a little bit, and you did a little bit with Renato in terms of looking for the person, the meditator. You can also use a more direct approach, like we did in a couple of meditations, by looking at the mind. So there we're not using any sort of logical reasoning as part of the investigation. We are simply looking directly. Where is the mind? Does it have any physical characteristics? We're not using any logical reasoning there. We're just looking directly. So that's more the approach that we find in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen, the nature of the mind, is that more direct looking approach versus a more logical reasoning approach to come to the same point. So both, of course, are valid, and both will eventually arrive at the experience of emptiness. So we can use which approach sort of works for us more effectively.
Logical reasoning always, for me, is like thinking and having a kind of concept.
It's not thinking. No. The logical approach that we used would be an example. Let's say there's a house, it has two rooms. Mm-hmm. And we see someone go into the house. And we're going to look for them. The logical approach goes, okay, I saw them go in the house. I know the house has two rooms. If I look in this room and I look in this room and I don't see them, they're not in the house. That's the logical approach. But then when we look, we don't think when we're looking for them, do we? We just look. We look in room A, we look in room B, but based on our logical reasoning, as soon as we look in room B and we don't see, we go, they're not in the house. But we're not thinking, are we, at that point?
At that point, not anymore.
No.
Before, there has to be some reasoning.
Exactly. Because otherwise, if we didn't have that reasoning, mm-hmm. when we looked in the first room and the second room, it wouldn't occur to us that they're not in the house, because we may think there may be some room upstairs or something. So we don't have the logical reasoning that really is like, boof, they're not in the house, because we understood. If we look here and here and we don't find, they're not in the house. If we don't have the logical reasoning, we can do the same process, look there and look there, and still be going, I don't know. Maybe they're upstairs. Maybe there's another room or something. I don't know. So that's the logical approach.
Okay.
Whereas the other approach is just looking directly. We just look, not seeing, and eventually we go, oh, it doesn't exist. So that's the more direct approach. But in both of them, when we investigate, we're not thinking.
Yeah.
We have a logical framework for the first one. And the second one is a more direct look, rather than without all that logical framework. But in both of them, when we investigate, we are simply looking directly.
In Buddhism, they talk about how things exist. Do they mention why do they exist?
Causes and conditions.
Why are there causes and conditions?
Because of causes and conditions.
Why do we exist, though?
because of causes and conditions.
Okay.
Yeah. Why are you here now? Because you existed yesterday. We can keep going back, beginningless time. That's why you're here now. Because of all of those causes and conditions.
Why is there beginningless time?
Hmm?
Why is there a beginningless time for that second one?
Because nothing can come without a cause. And even physics says that.
Hmm.
You know, the beginnings of the universe, they often talk about Big Bang. But I think there's no physicist that would say that means the universe popped into existence from nothing. No one would say that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the beginning of the universe? Why did the universe come? Because of the Big Bang. What's the Big Bang? Some infinitesimally dense thing. And of course, the question they haven't sort of asked is, where did the Big Bang come from? What was before the Big Bang? They haven't really gone there yet. Although one theory talks about multiple Big Bangs. So one theory is that before the Big Bang, there was a universe that collapsed, and then it exploded, collapsed, exploded. And actually, this is more or less the Buddhist view of cosmology. This multiple Big Bang theory is more or less the Buddhist answer. Okay, we've run over time, so let's stop there.